Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you are the generous sort, you can be like Brian, Jody, Jerry, Garrett, Ben, Janet, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you are able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Podcast shirts, hoodies, and stickers on our Teespring store. So check it out. Our guest today is Heather Bauer-Reed. Heather is a PhD student in the Integrative Fish Ecology Lab at Trent University, supervised by Dr. Graham Raby. Heather's research is focused on understanding the intraspecific variation in physiological and behavioral responses of fishes to climate change stressors. Heather completed her MSc at McGill University, where she examined the effects of climate change on invasive fish species. Prior to graduate school, Heather attended the University of British Columbia, where she earned her BSc in environmental sciences. Welcome to the podcast, Heather.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
To start off, have you always had an interest in fisheries and fish research?
I would say no. I think I always wanted to be in biology of some kind. I used to say to my mother that my first word was rainforest, which absolutely it wasn't. That's a straight lie. But it was that kind of thing where I was really interested. I thought I wanted to be a tropical rainforest researcher, that kind of thing. And it was only through co-op in undergrad and then a fish course that I took, actually, near the end of undergrad, where I thought fish might be kind of the coolest thing you can study, in my opinion. And that's how I got into it. And I've just kind of rolled with it from there.
Let's talk about your fisheries research journey so far. You completed your undergraduate degree in environmental sciences at the University of British Columbia. While at UBC, you participated in a co-op work experience program. What field of work was your co-op program focused on, and what kind of work did you do?
So I, for some reason, took the job. The first job that I took was the furthest away from UBC. I went to northeastern New Brunswick to work at an oyster hatchery, which was a town of 2,500 people. They all spoke Acadian French. It was probably the most different experience I had had up until then. And I learned that I didn't want to live there anymore. But also, it was a really cool experience just to get that side of things that was less academic as well. And I really, really fell in love with New Brunswick. So I tried and succeeded in doing the rest of my co-op in New Brunswick as well. So I went to Fredericton to work for Environment Canada and then finagled another job for the summer to stay at in Fredericton working at UNB doing salt marsh research. So all of those different jobs, one commercial hatchery, one for government, and one in academia, kind of gave me a diversity of experiences that let me kind of filter out what I wanted to do and what I didn't want to do. And I think was a really important experience for me in terms of setting my path and my interests, which I really, really appreciate looking back on it.
How long was your co-op experience?
So it was 16 months straight. I just periodically went back to Vancouver to visit my family. But it was kind of like I did 8 months at the hatchery. I was supposed to only do 4, but I really enjoyed it. While in one position, you apply for the next, basically. And I applied for about the only positions in New Brunswick and got them, which I loved.
So what would a typical day working in an oyster hatchery involve?
A lot of, honestly, washing baby oysters off of, so because they like to stick and settle, they try and settle. So it's really making sure that they don't stick to things, a lot of that, and they're pretty messy. So like cleaning up after babies, essentially, is a lot of what it is. I got to do a little side project as well, doing some water quality because they draw water directly from the bay and actually keep oysters out in the bay once they're older. So trying to do that, there's a lot of issues with contamination or like E. coli from birds. So just trying to keep an eye on water quality is important with the oysters to make sure that they're safe to eat.
Following your co-op experiences, you decided to pursue an independent study at UBC. Tell us about that.
While I was working in New Brunswick, I got it in mind because I was working with graduate students and researchers, and I had never really thought about independent research or going to grad school before doing co-op, which was another way that it was really valuable for me. I got to thinking that I'd like to do an independent project once I went back to UBC. So I reached out to a couple people and got in touch with Chris Harley, who works with marine invertebrates and climate change work at UBC, and got to do a project with him. So I basically went out at low tide in the winter to collect this tiny snail, a Littorhynid snail, and bring them back to the lab and do some cold exposure experiments with them. And it was a really helpful and eye-opening experience, I think, because I got to ask one question, and then when I got the results of that experiment, kind of ask more questions and go on from there. And working closely with Chris was really cool, and it was just a great kind of first dipping my toes into like my own research.
So what was the overall research objective of your independent study?
Following the exposure experiments, we decided to determine whether thermally buffered microhabitats like the bottoms of boulders or under algae cover could potentially help them not be so as negatively affected by cold exposure during low tide during the winter. So we brought in algae-covered rocks to the lab and exposed them to cold temperatures again on exposed and covered surfaces, things like that, and determined that the snails do flip over. That was our measure of performance, an activity measure, essentially, that they do recover more quickly while in a potentially thermally buffered microhabitat. The overarching conclusion of this study was that thermal heterogeneity on intertidal shores is probably an important component to the resilience of a species to temperature stress, because this probably also could extend to high heat events in the summer as well, though other studies have looked at that. Mine was more rounding out that aspect of things. Fewer studies look at cold stress.
After graduating from UBC and completing your independent study, you moved on to graduate school. You completed your master's at McGill University in Montreal, Quebec, in the Invasion Ecology and Aquatic Ecosystems Lab. I briefly mentioned your research earlier. You were studying the interpopulation variation in thermal responses by invasive freshwater fish. So let's dive into the fundamentals of that research. First, what was your study area and the fish species that you were focused on?
My study area was the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Basin. So from Lake Erie all the way up to the St. Lawrence River around Sorel, which is past Montreal. And my study species was the round goby, which is a really cute little guy. They were first detected in the 1990s. In Lake St. Clair, and since then have spread throughout the Great Lakes region. They number in the billions, as far as I understand it. They originate from the Caspian and Black Seas, probably entered the Great Lakes region through ballast water, and have maintained their foothold ever since.
What was the focus of your research on round gobies?
So I decided to look at their thermal tolerance and feeding behavior across a number of acclimation temperatures in order to better understand how separate populations with little to no contact with one another may respond to climate change. I acclimated fish from each of four populations. So Western Lake Erie, Hamilton Harbor, and then two populations in the St. Lawrence River to temperatures between 18 and 28 degrees, and then measured their thermal tolerance in the form of critical thermal maximum and their feeding behavior. So I gave them a fixed amount of food and counted how many food items they ate in a fixed amount of time to determine how their feeding behavior is affected by temperature.
So what were the main findings of your research?
I found different thermal tolerances across populations. The most significant finding was that, as is seen with most fish species, or in the literature anyway, the thermal tolerance of the fish from Lake Erie and Lake Ontario increased linearly with acclimation temperature. So at the highest acclimation temperature, their thermal tolerance was at its peak. It may be that if I had acclimated them to an even higher temperature, their thermal tolerance could have been higher, though there would be a ceiling somewhere. But the St. Lawrence populations, which are from a more northerly latitude, had lower CTmax overall and actually had a decline in thermal tolerance at the highest acclimation temperature. So between 26 and 28 degrees, which were two of my treatment temperatures, they seemed to hit some sort of threshold and their thermal tolerance actually declined. So it peaked more like 25 or 26 degrees rather than at 28. It was not a linear increase. It actually had a decrease at the end in the final acclimation temperature. And feeding behavior also declined with temperature broadly. It was more variable. Behavior is often quite variable. That's just the nature of it. But for most, broadly speaking, the number of prey items eaten by gobies was lowest at the highest acclimation temperature.
How did you measure CTmax? So how did you know when certain populations had reached their threshold at 25 or 28 degrees, for example?
You increase the temperature at a fixed rate. I tested two fish at a time in a tank with circulating water that was increasing the water temperature of the water bath at a fixed rate, in my case, approximately 0.3 degrees Celsius per minute. And you determine when the endpoint, when the fish loses equilibrium. And for gobies, unfortunately, they lack a swim bladder. So I had to manually flip them to determine when they could no longer remain upright. Otherwise, they would just kind of sit there forever, stuck on the bottom. There was trial and error in working out the best way of that, but I got a pretty good system with that, and all my data were consistent, so I was confident in that method.
How do you envision the findings of your research being applied in a broader context?
The populations that I looked at, I also measured the temperatures in those locations and found that Lake Erie and Lake Ontario had reached higher temperatures in summer. And so it makes sense that they may be more tolerant to higher temperatures, as it's often observed that species or populations that are exposed to higher temperatures in their natural environment have a higher thermal tolerance, may conversely have less tolerance to colder temperatures, things like that. It depends on your thermal experience a lot of the time. And so I found my findings that the St. Lawrence populations have a lower tolerance overall, and then this decline at a high temperature could mean that they may be less equipped to handle the increasing temperatures that we're seeing in different aquatic environments. As an invasive species, successful invaders are anticipated to have broader tolerances and a greater capacity to acclimate to different conditions, which enables them to be very successful in their invaded ranges. And so if the different goby populations that I studied have different acclimation capacities, that could mean that their impacts in the future also differ. If their feeding rates decline at high temperatures, that could mean that they have less impact, though it's likely that 28 degrees is bad for everybody, or most fish anyway. I guess a main takeaway from that research that I'm carrying into my PhD as well is just that these populations across relevant scales, not just really broad latitudinal scales, but even within the same region, can show variation in their behavior and physiology, which impacts the ability to manage them and conservation efforts for native species and things like that. So treating a species as a single unit, so if I measured the CT max of a Lake Erie goby that and applied that to management in the St. Lawrence River, that wouldn't necessarily be accurate.
Currently, you are a PhD student in the Integrative Fish Ecology Lab at Trent University, supervised by Dr. Graham Raby. The overarching theme of your dissertation is similar to your master's and undergraduate research in that you're aiming to understand the variable effects of temperature on aquatic species. Tell us more about your project. What are the main objectives of your research?
As you say, my PhD builds on the previous work that I've done, particularly my master's. And so the overarching goals of what I'm trying to do are to, again, shed light on that intraspecific variation that exists within species, which doesn't always get as much attention, at least in some, in various aspects, and to look at how different things are driving intraspecific variation, specifically past and present environmental conditions, as well as other forms of intraspecific variation like life history, and how that all ties together into the physiological and behavioral responses to climate change, specifically temperature.
What species are you going to be focusing on?
Currently, I'm looking at a variety of different species, actually. So I'm working with brook trout, walleye, and pumpkin seed, kind of spanning the range of temperature tolerances in theory with that and looking at different aspects of them. So I'll be evaluating swimming performance of brook trout, behavior of walleye in the Great Lakes, and the effect of life history variation on metabolism in pumpkin seed.
Outside of school, you've had some amazing experiences. Specifically, you worked in Bermuda for a summer at the Bermuda Institute of Ocean Sciences. How did you come upon this position?
That's a good question. I don't remember. I think I was looking for summer opportunities and stumbled upon a specific Canadian application. So there's funding through BIOS for Canadian students to have a research experience and be hosted at the Bermuda Institute of Ocean Sciences, and applied for it on a whim and managed to get it, which was very exciting to be able to go and stay there and spend a summer in Bermuda.
And while in Bermuda, what work and research did you get to assist with?
I was working on identifying resource availability for invasive lionfish in mesophotic zones. Basically, what that involved was lionfish in Bermuda are most abundant in the mesophotic zone, which is deeper than they're usually observed in other areas that they've invaded. And part of what they were working on when I was there was determining what they're eating while they're down there. So they would drop these baited remote underwater video setups, or BRUVs, down, record for about an hour, and then bring them back up. And so I was going through the videos to identify what species were there and approximate their sizes to see what was a potential food source for the lionfish in these zones around Bermuda.
Prior to starting your PhD at Trent, you worked for a year with an NGO in New Brunswick. Tell us about that.
Sure. I first got to experience hotel quarantine when I moved to New Brunswick. At the end of my master's, I applied for number of jobs and ended up getting one in New Brunswick, which I was really excited about to go back. I couldn't stay away, I guess. And while I was moving there, I got to enjoy the experience of hotel quarantine, which was great. But once I was there, I worked on, it was a pretty small team, but we worked on a bunch of different projects, restoration projects, water quality monitoring, coastal community monitoring, and outreach initiatives. It was a really well-rounded experience. I got to work on a bunch of different projects, not just the aquatic projects that I was leading. And that was a really exciting opportunity for me to see how an NGO is run and then also get to experience all these different things. I really enjoyed my time working for ACAP St. John. I guess it was a really nice experience after grad school, and I got to feel part of the community because St. John is quite small and everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people in town know the organization, call us up directly. People come to the office, and it really felt like a community organization doing things for the community, which was a really nice experience. And I really enjoyed the projects that I got to lead and co-lead. And I got to work on some really cool stuff like toxicology in the St. John Harbor, which ended up becoming a paper out of UNB, out of a UNB student's honors thesis.
You mentioned that you helped participate in a number of projects, both leading and co-leading. Did you happen to have a favorite project that you worked on? And if so, what was it?
I would say the coastal community monitoring project was the most exciting. That was the one that I was most involved in. It involved monthly sampling of the fish communities at a number of different sites. So putting out nets and identifying what was there, we got to see some pretty cool fish. Sometimes we caught a lot of fish, but anytime you get to hang out with fish is fun. So that was probably the most exciting part.
Last summer, you participated in a unique graduate-level fish swimming course run by the University of Washington, run out of Friday Harbor Laboratories. What does a graduate-level fish swimming course entail?
Yeah, so it entails 5 weeks of pretty intense work. It starts off with some lectures. It was run by three leading fish physiologists from different universities all over the world and brought together PhD students and a couple master's students, anybody who wanted to take it essentially, but it was largely PhD students from all over the world as well, and culminated in us breaking into groups and working on independent projects with the idea that they would lead to publications. So it was a lot of work that was really, really rewarding and unlike any course I had ever taken, especially since it was so intensive being only 5 weeks long.
That sounds like a wonderful experience. What was the focus of your group project?
So my main project was, again, following in my theme of one of my themes of thermal biology. We looked at the effects of heat wave conditions on swimming performance of a marine fish species.
What was it like taking this course and how was it living in the residence at Friday Harbor Labs? Just tell us more about that experience in general.
It was really, really exciting to kind of build the cohort with these other students from all these different universities. And it was amazing to live at Friday Harbor. I feel like I had heard about it before going, about how great it is, and it turns out it is actually pretty great. The residences were pretty good. We all got to live next door to each other, essentially. One of the main things I take away from it is actually my memories of like the wildlife around. I saw killer whales from the shore of the lab. We would be almost face to face with seals sometimes. We got to catch many cool fish species, and all around it was just a really great, chaotic bonding experience. I feel like they packed a lot into a short period of time that I can really take away and then bring the things that I've learned to my degree.
Well, Heather, now that the tough part of the interview is over, we are down to the final five questions. This is a group of five questions that I ask each of the guests that come on the show. We always start simple with, what is your favorite fish?
One of my favorite fish is probably the ratfish or chimera. I actually got to work with them a bit at Friday Harbor, which may have been my academic peak. I don't know. And another one, it would be the Toby. There's a bunch of different kinds. It's a really cute little puffer kind of guy. They're kind of like, they're also called long-nosed puffers that you see a lot scuba diving in like the tropical Pacific. And I just think they're the cutest things I've ever seen.
What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Recent memory, I would say, was I just gushed about Friday Harbor, but it is a great memory. 5 weeks of memories, just the whole experience. And then if I wanted to take it further back, I would say my undergraduate fish course was a pretty formative experience, and doing a field trip for that to the Bamfield Marine Sciences Center on Vancouver Island kind of seemed to, it's maybe cliche to say, spark my interest in fish. I was already interested in fish, but I think it helped solidify for me what I wanted to do. And it was during this course that I started applying for master's programs working with fish. So it seems to me that that experience is a formative memory in setting my career path.
What is your dream job?
Having worked in a variety of different aspects of aquatic science, I think I don't know right now what my ideal job would be, but I do know that I want to keep on the fish path, the fish route.
If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I'm gonna throw a curveball here and say that, independent of fish, one thing I think would be really amazing to study is venomous marine animals. I took a really cool upper year marine invertebrates class in undergrad and studied venom evolution. And I think if I could, there's an alternate reality me where I became a venom ecologist in Australia or something like that and studied cone snails and how their venom evolved in comparison to jellyfish, things like that. I think venom is a really cool evolutionary tactic that in another life could have been what I study. And if I had all the money in the world, I would try and slot that into my research somehow.
If there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
For the majority of my research so far, a primary focus has been that we shouldn't necessarily treat species as a monolith. They have a lot of variation across populations and individuals within a species, and that is gaining attention. It's had attention in some groups for a long time, but overall is gaining attention more in recent years. But I wish that was programmed into people's minds already, that one group of fish of a certain species in one place may not behave or have the same responses to stressors as a group or population in another location. And I think that's important to remember and is kind of a main focus of my research.
Heather, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all of your work. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Sure. If you want to reach me, you can reach me at my email, which is heatherreid, R-E-I-D, at trendu.ca. Or you can try to reach me on Twitter, where my handle is Heather B. Reid.
If you would like to get a hold of us, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget that you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Caitlin Cunningham. Thank you for listening to the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, don't ignore the variation that can exist within a species.